And then he managed to change the topic quickly, which means he was super stoked to get back to spooning with Bacon.
Yeah. Welcome to Bad Voltage On Live. This is episode 37, after we finally made our way back, slouchingly and horribly, from Los Angeles to wherever horrible places we live now. A normal show.
For varying definitions of normal.
What are we doing normal show, Jono?
So we're, excuse me, frog in the throat. There we go. Frog's no longer in the throat. All right, so I'm going to do a review of the 3D Robotics Iris Plus drone and talk about how droney it is and whether you should get one.
And we're going to talk to Dave Nielsen, who's the founder of Campsite, the co-founder of Cloud Camp, and also helped with a little bit of the sponsorship for Bad Voltage Live.
And then we're going to talk about net neutrality and how the United States government wants to take away your internet.
And we're going to hold Brian's arms and then punch him in the stomach, neatly disguised, as a question, why is OpenSUSE relevant and why should we use it?
What's it time for?
And now, Bad Voltage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've discussed a whole bunch of Linux-based OSs on this show in the past. Or when I say a whole bunch, I mean Ubuntu and nothing else. Now, it occurs
pretty
to me
much.
That's funny because it's true.
Captain Brian, with his baseball cap on, actually works for and with OpenSUSE. And I don't really, hand on heart, I don't really know what the SUSE project or the OpenSUSE project are up to. I mean, I'd be interested in knowing what's going on and what's cool and what they're doing that keeps them relevant. In this day and age, is there anything?
To add a little bit more color on that, like before Brian starts the propaganda.
Oh man, I have so much propaganda.
I was going to say, I'm actually going to jump in before Brian because he works there, so I'm the neutral third party here.
There is no doubt that like there's lots of different distros, and what I'd like to know from you, Brian, is to Axe's point, like how is OpenSUSE relevant, and I think more interestingly different. Like what? Why should I use OpenSUSE? If I'm just a brand new to Linux, why should I use OpenSUSE outside of the fact that I was bribed with a fucking chameleon at an expo?
Okay. I'm going to reply to that. And then I want to hear from Jeremy before I start ranting on this. To start with, that little stuffed chameleon is freaking adorable. Jeremy?
It is. So I have to say, I have not really heard of SUSE much since Greg Cage is no longer working there and he stopped running Tumbleweed. And obviously, the for lack of a better word, the great Linus bashing of 2012, which
that was
stuck
fun,
the
right?
boot in pretty severely. So I have to say, I was standing around the OpenSUSE booth and I started talking to a guy named Peter Linnell, I believe his name was.
Yeah.
And I'm actually shocked that how much SUSE seems to quietly be doing, because they seem to be doing a ton. So I've just looked around a little bit afterwards. They're doing more than I would have thought with Ceph, considering Red Hat just bought it.
Yep.
Right, they're like fifth or sixth in kernel contributions last year. They're in the top 10 of OpenStack contributions. The list of stuff that OpenSUSE is doing and doing successfully and quietly, I was, to be quite honest, astonished and fairly impressed. Because, you know, when I think of SUSE, I think I ran it in maybe like 94, and actually found, look at this, SUSE 5.2 CD.
Oh, you got a 5.2 disk.
And nice. The official 5.3 one, which...
Oh, yeah, this is back in the days of the seven... And this the is back in the days of the seven disc box sets, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing I always thought, the thing that struck me as odd and when SUSE went a little off the rails is when they were primarily the KDE distro, right? Yeah. So when they acquired Xymion, it seemed like the oddest of acquisitions, and it seemed to be kind of the end of when you heard about him a lot. So I'm interested, Brian, you having a little bit of insider information and insight there. Let us know what more they're doing than what I was even able to see. Because
What's going on, Brian? What's the deal?
All right. So to start with, OpenSUSE and SUSE stuff in general is very agnostic over technology. So it's not a KDE distro. It's not a GNOME distro. It's a distro that focuses on supporting as many desktop environments and technologies as humanly possible, supporting them, testing them, maintaining them, contributing to them, just getting involved in them. That way, people can choose. It's a very...
So kind of like Debian. In a way.
So yeah, you know, it's like Debian with more testing. I mean, is kind of a good way to think about it. You know, so
harsh to the Debian.
No, I mean that. I mean that in all.
Also harsh to. Also harsh to, you know, fax as well.
No. It's all right. I'm just going to move on from that. I have things I could say on that, but. but you know, so like the neutral third party Jeremy pointed out, SUSE just kind of gets involved in a lot of projects, even projects that are owned and maintained by some of SUSE's fiercest competitors, and contributes to them where it thinks it can make a difference, where it thinks it can make a positive impact. And I love that. I love that style. You know, they don't sit down and they think, oh, you know, we need to create an entire new desktop environment. We need to create a new window manager. We're not going to work with upstream projects very well. They don't do those things that no sane Linux or open source company would do. They act really responsibly within the open source world. And not that they're the only ones that do that. Red Hat does a really good job as well. So do a lot of other companies. But I like that about it. But here's the thing that does it for me for OpenSUSE and a lot of the SUSE stuff in general. It's not the distro. Because the reality is, Ubuntu is a good distro. Debian's a good distro. Fedora is a good distro. These are all really good distros that, you know, use like 99% of the same code, right? I mean, they're almost the same thing, like 99% of the time. That 1% does make a big difference, but what makes an even bigger difference are the tools and things that exist around the distro. You know, if you go to use OpenSUSE, you can use things like the Open Build Service, which lets you as a developer package your software for literally every Linux distro on the planet. Arch in the AUR, Ubuntu,
that
everything.
That is very cool.
It'll even build Windows installers for your apps if they're cross-platform. You can then go over to things like SUSE Studio and build basically your own custom distro based on the technology behind OpenSUSE, just with a point-and-click website without really having to work all that hard. And it's actually extraordinarily cool and powerful. And these are technologies and tools that no one else creates. And it's not just that no one else in the Linux world creates them. No one on Windows or on the Apple side create things like this either. And those tools are just so powerful, not just for end users who want to do something kind of fun and funky, or businesses that want to create, you know, kiosk distros or whatever, what have you, with SUSE Studio, but it's powerful for everyone, all the way up to enterprisey stuff. And it's so cool. It's cool technology. It's technology that when you see it demoed, you're like, damn, that's cool. Not, oh, you built a new display server. It's legitimately important and new technology that actually is important and is actually valuable. That's what does it for me for SUSE. That's what gets me excited about it.
The thing is, though,
I will say the jabs are subtle.
That's how I roll subtle.
So while you talk about how SUSE, you know, doesn't create brand new completely things, you're talking about things like Yast and XGL, things like that.
Yes. .. All right. So on that front, those were related to, I mean, external projects as well. There were people working on them from outside of SUSE as well.
Yast gets a little bit different
because for a long time Yast was architected badly. It was actually written, well, not badly. That's a strong word. It was built in a language that was basically built for developing Yast, and which made it basically hard to do anything with it if you weren't already comfortable with working on Yast. And that changed recently. They ported it over to Ruby and stuff. And so now other people can get involved with it. Other distros can work more closely with it. And that makes it a lot nicer. The focus is on opening things up as much as possible, not just source
the thing
code.
The thing is, I don't think anyone would disagree that SUSE is very responsible within the traditional convention of what a Linux distribution is. Like you say, SUSE has support for GNOME and KDE and things like that. And you only have to go and look at the SUSE Wikipedia page to show the sundry contributions to a variety of different projects. The concern that I have, and you haven't really answered our question, is that's all great, but why should I use it? Because I think the concern that I have is that SUSE is one of those things that I look at and I think, that's cool, but there's nothing unique about it. Like, why should I use SUSE and not use Fedora or use Debian or one of the other distributions that hasn't take such bold and controversial decisions as Ubuntu has? We you know, you either love Ubuntu or you hate it, I'd say. Whereas with the other distros, there's a certain amount of people distro hop a lot. But why should people use OpenSUSE compared to the other distros that aren't Ubuntu?
The short version is because it's awesome. The long version,
it's just
a personal thing. Yeah, that settles it. Let's stop recording.
Now, I found that pretty convincing.
No, it's
sold.
So, I can see why they hired you.
Again, 99% of the code for Fedora, OpenSUSE, Ubuntu is really the same. And we were pulling from most of the same upstream projects. I mean, there are some differences here and there with package management. There are some differences here and there with desktop environments, you know, in some cases. But the reality is it's mostly the same system. What you're getting to is, what's that 1% difference? If you were to look at it, why I don't use Fedora very often is because Fedora for many releases was a very buggy release, especially in like the installer was very buggy and whatnot. It used to be very rock solid and it's gotten much more rock solid recently, but for several releases, it was very buggy. So I didn't really use Fedora much. I used to be a Fedora guy. That's what I ran. And I stopped using it because it was so buggy for so long. And then once I realized that OpenSUSE was this good quality release still, and it had been quality, and every single release has a consistent quality bar, I felt like, okay, I can rely on this to be continuing to work going forward because it's been doing it for the last 20 years. I mean, SUSE is the oldest Linux company in existence. I mean, there isn't an older.
You're still not telling us why we should use it. Like, why should we?
But it is,
well,
though.
Well, hang on.
Go ahead.
Let me express perhaps the same question from a different angle, right? If you compare me to me 7, 8, 10 years ago, right, the thing that's changed is that I don't feel like I want to fiddle with my environment anymore, right? I don't want to the joy of building the perfect environment for me. I want someone else to build the perfect environment to me and then give it to me with no effort, right? The distinction between, in my mind, what you're describing for what SUSE does, Brian, and what, say, Ubuntu does, is that Ubuntu say, right, here is your environment, use it. If you don't like it, go somewhere else. Right. SUSE is about giving you the power and the tools to build the perfect environment for you, which means that if you're someone who wants that, I can absolutely see why that would be useful. I don't know whether this is just because I've got older and I'm not interested in it, so I think no one else is either, but it does feel to me like the vast majority of people don't want to build an environment in the same way that most people don't want to build a house, even though you'd get the perfect house for you exactly like you wanted it.
Default choice being bad? Can't their default, and I say this not having used OpenSUSE in years, but can't you have a situation where the default choice is good, but then they also give you choice?
Yes. Oh, well, I would think so. I mean, to some extent, that's what Ubuntu does.
Let me ask you guys a question, because I see where you're getting at, Stuart. I totally do. It's a valid question. What's the most recent version of OpenSUSE that you guys have used for more than a couple minutes?
That's why I'm asking the question.
Such a donkey's ears.
Okay, that's why you should use OpenSUSE. Go try it.
Because we haven't used it. Hang on a second.
Yes, absolutely.
I also haven't used Yggdrasil in years, and I'm not about to go download the latest version of Yggdrasil and install it.
You totally should use Yggdrasil or whatever, however we want to pronounce it, and give it another try. Absolutely.
It's from the leaves of Yggdrasil.
All right, here's the thing, right? This conversation reminds me, in many ways, of the conversation about scopes. you asked us very explicitly why anyone would use scopes,
yeah.
and we didn't give suitable answers. And
you know what
I'm not hearing any.
Do you know what
any,
I did?
Anything?
What did I do? I turned around and
what
I
you
spent
did,
weeks.
Turned to the community.
I spent weeks using scopes, trying to use it, using Ubuntu Touch on my tablet, trying to use the latest and greatest, talking to the community, asking my friends, and getting as involved as I could. Do I like it? No, I think it's really friggin' stupid. But I tried it, and you know what? It's important to try it. We're nerds here, guys.
Here's a compromise.
And importantly, we're Linux nerds. If we're not out there seeing what the community's doing, if we're not out there trying the new desktop environments, seeing what the Linux distros are doing, then we're not Linux nerds anymore. We're just Ubuntu users, and that's way less cool.
All right, Braveheart. Here's the thing, right? All right, let's do this. So, I would like to ask the OpenSUSE community to come to the Bad Voltage Forum and explain why we should use OpenSUSE in the same way we did with scopes. And in addition to this, I'm going to cause some work for the rest of us. Brian, Jeremy, and myself, I think that before the next show, we should all try and use OpenSUSE. Not for a couple of minutes. We should actually try and do something with it. We're not going to move to our main desktop.
Nah, shut up.
Sorry.
Shut up.
No.
No, I'm not doing it.
Jeremy, and I think we should use it. And I think what we should do in the next show...
I'll install it before the next show.
I think we should do a joint review.
Do a joint review.
I think we should do a joint review in the next show. We've never done that before.
Fuck you, Jeremy Garson.
You know what?
I got out of that.
Here, I'm gonna put this out there just to when you guys are using it. One of the great things about OpenSUSE are the extremely polished and well-tested versions of so many desktop environments. Pick one, pick two, try three of them out. My general impression is using OpenSUSE and KDE, GNOME, a variety, heck, even Enlightenment using the latest version, I would say is a significantly faster, more stable, and more fun environments to work with than Ubuntu's Unity.
All right,
is there a version of Unity then that doesn't crash all the time?
No.
Available for SUSE?
No.
Let's do this then.
Unity
all right,
crashes
Jeremy,
everywhere.
Jeremy, you're going to use GNOME. I'll use KDE. Ak, you're going to use Enlightenment. Sorry, Ak.
I'll use something. It might not be Enlightenment. It does sound rather like Brian saying, if you're
I was
going
to say, I'll probably try a few just to see how the transition is.
Yeah.
If you're the sort of person who changes your environment around a lot, then SUSE is a good place to do that.
Yeah.
And therefore, we'll give that a go. I suspect I'll find it difficult precisely because I'm not the sort of person who wants to jump around a lot. And it's difficult to distinguish my desire not to do that with saying, though I don't want to do that,
then just
SUSE
makes
it good. But
just
we'll give
pick GNOME or KDE then. But if you pick GNOME or KDE,
here's
so that's easy, yeah.
But here's the rule. Each of us have got to actually do something with it.
Yep,
like
that's
we can't
fair.
Just load it up, look at it. We've each got to accomplish a task with it. All right, so OpenSUSE community, you have a task as well. Brian, you have a job. Go to community.badvoltage.org and start a thread. And then OpenSUSE community, go to that thread and tell us why we should use
tell
it. Like, what's unique? What's special? Right? And let's have a conversation.
Love it.
All right, now on the show, we've got Dave Nielsen, who plays a number of different roles in the world. He is the co-founder of the popular cloud camps that happen all over the world. He is also a regular unconference organizer in other areas as well. He's the founder of Campsite, which is kind of like meetup.com. He's also the bank of Bad Voltage as well. He helped us to launder some money so we could do Bad Voltage Live. Dave,
thanks
welcome
that,
to the show.
The
how are you doing?
That's great. Now I'm really disappointed when I use my real name because we'll see.
Do you want to be Pablo? Do you want to be Pablo Nielsen? I mean, you want this to work? So, all right.
That's okay.
So, the thing that most people who listen to this have probably heard of is going to be the cloud camps. I mean, you know, do you want to explain what cloud camps are and how they got started?
Oh yeah, sure. You know, it's a very interesting but long story to tell, but I'll give you the kind of quick version, which is that I had been very drawn to the unconference model ever since I went to Tim O'Reilly's Foo Camp in 2004. I was working for PayPal at the time and went with Dave McClure of 500 Startup fame, and it was my first experience where you don't prepare the schedule ahead of time, and instead you know, we had the open spaces and there were about 150 or so people standing around. And when the spaces was opened, some of them went up right. and put their topics down. And it was really the first time I'd ever seen it. I think it was pretty early in the unconference space. I was more starstruck by the people who were there. You know, Jeff Bezos was standing right behind me, you know, Ev Williams was still the founder of Blogger at the time, but, you know, well-known. Anyway, right. it was a very interesting weekend. Fast forward a couple of years, I got involved with something called Mashup Camp, which was an unconference, but on a vertical topic. And it was really the first time I've ever seen one done on a vertical topic. And since I was super enthusiastic around cloud computing, I decided I wanted to do one around called Cloud Camp. So I went and registered the domain name cloudcamp.org because right. I noticed that cloudcamp.com was taken. And then a couple months later, as I was, you know, thinking through how I was going to launch this thing, I was on a Google group called Just Cloud Computing, and this guy shot out a message saying, "Hey, I'm going to be in San Francisco for Velocity and Structure, and I was thinking about doing a cloud computing unconference, you know, between the two." And
right.
his name is Reuben Cohen. And I said, "Reuben, I've been thinking about doing the same thing. You know, I'd love to help organize. And not only that, I've got the domain name cloudcamp.org I can contribute." And he said, "I've got cloudcamp.com." That's how we met.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, so that was the instigation of Cloud Camp.
And, you know, paint a picture of how many of these things, because there's loads of them, right? They're all over the world. How many are there, and how did you grow the community to be that big?
Well, I can tell you the smart things we did and the not-so-smart things we did. So the smart thing we did is we made it open and free to attend. We also made it an interesting format for helping people learn how cloud computing can apply to them. So we really focused on education and learning, like the concepts, and in a very open discussion format. And that was very appealing to a large number of people. We also made sure there was always somebody who was sort of a name who would show up. So somebody interesting would be there that would kind of like attract people. Hey, at least we know that this guy will be there to help us understand this stuff. We also kind of opened the brand. We basically said anybody can do this. All you have to do is, you know, don't commercialize it. Don't try to like launch your product at the event if you're the organizer. You know, stay neutral as an organizer and we'll help you. So all those things were appealing to people. And I think it really helped spread it fast.
Right.
So that was kind of like the smart thing we did. We had the domain name, we had the Twitter handle, you know, we did a lot of social media that promoted just, you know, free stuff that we all knew how to do.
Right.
So that's basically how we got it going. And that was, I think, a smart approach to it.
One of the questions I'd have, the original concept of an unconference was, it had the Fight Club property, right? If this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight. If you were attending the unconference, you had to give a talk. That seems to have largely gone away now. Do you do that for Cloud Camp?
No, we don't require people to give a talk, but we do encourage folks to use their 2 feet, you know, the law of 2 feet. So if they're in a session and the session isn't interesting to them, or, you know, they're not able to contribute anything, we encourage them to find another session to participate in. And I think that kind of keeps the topics sort of moving quickly and, you know, staying relevant, rather than having somebody, you know, start off with a bunch of their own ideas and take the session in a direction that's not that interesting. So it does keep people engaged that way. And we do encourage people to propose topics. So, there's not room for everybody to propose a topic, but we do get a lot of folks proposing topics and it keeps it lively that way as well.
All right. I gotta stop you, 'cause I need clarification around something here. All right. We're talking about unconferences, which really brings to mind to me Alice in Wonderland's unbirthday, which, if you remember right, every day but your birthday is your unbirthday. So isn't everything but a conference an unconference? And why would you need to schedule such a thing?
You know, I guess you're right. We're having an unconference right now.
Damn straight we are, because we definitely did not prepare this. So that much is clear.
Every show is an unconference. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, no, and see how well it's turning out. I think everything should be an unconference.
All right, so unconferences sound a lot to me like those birds of a feather tracks you get at actual conferences, you know, like the actual prepared conferences, but they have like the 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Everyone can sit around a table, drink beer and talk about, you know, whatever topic, talk about Ubuntu, and people can go and write on a whiteboard, I want to talk about this in Ubuntu. And no one ever comes up with an actual topic. They end up just sitting around a table for 2 hours and just thinking about what to talk about while drinking the free beer that the conference provided. And then in the last 15 minutes, they argue, bitch and moan about Mir. Is that essentially what unconferences are?
Well, you know, it could be, I suppose, but most of the time, I think folks are there for a particular topic, and they want to discuss that topic. And, you know, whereas at a regular conference, when you go to a Birds of a Feather, it kind of feels more like, oh, I'm going to go hang out with people that I, you know, I'm familiar with or that I relate to. And it's a little bit more of a social thing, and I don't think you care so much about necessarily learning something. At an unconference, it's more purposeful. You know, you're going there to discuss a topic. You're taking up your Saturday or an evening to go to one of these things. You went out of your way. I think there's a little bit more sense of an urgency to learn something.
I think in a lot of ways, CLS is kind of an unconference, right? Because the beginning's a little structured, but after that, you kind of break out.
Yeah. Yeah, I was
not to
say,
plug another co-presenter's conference, but...
But you should. yeah, I mean, the Community Leadership Summit is very much like that. And I would agree with you, Dave, that you actually get... The thing that's great about unconferences is that you get really surprising content. Like, if you have if you have a normal conference and you create structured content, then it's not surprising for most of the regular people who go there. Whereas you get really surprising topics that people would not feel the confidence to put in an actual call for, you know, submission for. Dave, before we're going to have to sadly bring this to a bit of a conclusion, but I'd like to make sure that we touch on one really interesting piece of work that you work on, which is campsite.org. Could you give us a quick overview of what that is and maybe why our listeners should be interested in it?
Yeah. Campsite is a project I've been working on for a couple of years. It's kind of moving from hobby stage to, you know, having actual customers and people using it. So it's kind of fun to see that change. It's also a lot of work. But Campsite's purpose is to essentially provide a community platform for organizers of unconference and other participant-driven events. Now, right. That's the main goal and the purpose of it, and it kind of has a website structure and feel like a meetup, like meetup.com, but it's more targeted at discussion-oriented events and workshops.
Gotcha.
Right, but it's about organizing the event ahead of time rather than running the schedule while you're at the event.
It does both.
All right, it does actually do both. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it does both, because we're not trying to push folks into a particular type of structure, but we want to encourage, we basically want to let them do whatever kind of event they want to do, and then encourage them to invite their attendees to participate online as well.
Awesome.
Nice.
Well,
do people go if they want to find out more about it?
Yeah, campsite.org is the website. It's nice. Kind of in an early beta right now, but if anybody's interested in working with me on it or running an event, just have them sign up, or they can also email me at dave@campsite.org.
And I just want to thank you as well, Dave, for much as we accused you of money laundering earlier on. Dave, for those of you who listen to the show, we obviously did Bad Voltage in LA. And Dave took care of the sponsorship money that we received from System 76 and distributed it to each of the guys in the team. You know, so many thanks, Dave, for taking care of that so I don't have to file taxes.
So, yeah, we really appreciate that. I do it all the time. Awesome. And if anybody out there needs to get some expense reports done for handling sponsorship money, I can take care of that for you.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Yeah, you bet. Glad to be there.
About a month ago, I became the proud owner of a 3D Robotics Iris Plus drone. Now, I have to say, I didn't know very much about drones, but I'm friends with Chris Anderson, founder of 3D Robotics, who some of you may remember we interviewed a while back on Bad Voltage. I asked Chris which drone he recommended I get started with, and he said that there was an Iris Plus, which retails for about $750, which is made by his company, with my name on it. So, firstly, thanks to 3D Robotics and Chris for the complimentary drone, and subsequently, this review. So what is this thing? Well, it's a pretty beefy drone. It's a quadcopter, like most drones you've seen, but the entire thing is built from open hardware and open source. Unlike some other drones, the Iris Plus comes pre-assembled and is pretty much ready to fly out the box. It's got three different flight modes. One mode is completely manual, in which you're in charge of ensuring it doesn't smash into your neighbor's car. The next mode uses the built-in GPS to stabilize the flight, which makes it much easier to control. The third mode, called Auto, allows you to connect your phone or tablet to the Iris Plus, draw a flight plan, and then upload it to the drone. It will then rise to the defined altitude, execute the flight plan, and return to land. One of the neatest aspects of the Iris Plus is its autopilot. It's got features such as Follow Me, where you can have the Iris Plus follow a tethered device, ideal for following, for example, a speeding mountain bike rider or a surfer. It's also got a return to base feature, so that if you ever get scared flying the thing, or the battery's running low, the Iris Plus will fly back to the GPS waypoint where it took off. It also has features such as not flying out of range based upon battery consumption. All of these features make the Iris Plus by far a great drone for beginners such as myself. Today, it seems that many drones are being used for aerial photography, and the Iris Plus is no different. While there is a standard camera mount, what you really want is the GoPro gimbal that allows you to hang a GoPro camera off the bottom of the Iris Plus. This gimbal has motors attached to it that auto-adjust the camera when in flight, so you get super stable and smooth footage. This, combined with the auto flight mode and a feature in which you can focus on a specific waypoint, provides options, for example, where you can circle the Iris Plus around a point and the drone smoothly adjusts its position in midair to focus the GoPro on a specific point. Ideal, for example, for filming a house, a monument, or any other specific area. The footage from this looks absolutely stunning and is surprisingly stable. In terms of build quality, the Iris Plus feels rock solid and sturdy. I've flown it now about 8 or 9 times and only crashed it once when I was worried it was going to auto-land on my neighbor's car. Little did I know at the time is that when it comes into auto-land, you can still control it to correct its landing. That misalignment has only happened once though. Even though I crashed it, the only damage was to the propellers, for which I bought a replacement set for about $20 from Amazon. In terms of how it flies, it's surprisingly easy, particularly when it is GPS supported in loiter mode. I'd never flown a radio controlled plane or helicopter before, so I was expecting to break this thing within a few minutes. It's so easy to fly though that it makes me look like the boss of the sky when showing it to friends and family. This is obviously a true testament to the onboard computers. It is also mind-blowing how high and how far this thing can go. This ain't no helicopter from Brookstones. This is a pretty serious aerial vehicle that when put up to maximum altitude and sent off into the distance, you can barely see it. It really does feel like a serious piece of kit, and its stabilization is so impressive that when you hover it a few feet above the ground and push it, it feels like a solid block in the air as it resists your pushback. In terms of battery life, with the Iris Plus with the GoPro gimbal and camera attached, you get about 15 minutes. Now, this is not brilliant, and I'm not sure whether this is the fault of the Iris Plus or the batteries in general. Fortunately, batteries are pretty cheap, so you can buy spares that you can use. So, what is the Bad Voltage verdict? The 3D Robotics Iris Plus looks, feels, and flies like a serious drone with serious capabilities, but was perfect for the beginner too. If you want to get into the future of Skynet, the Iris Plus is a great place to be.
I've got one question for you, Jono.
Yeah.
Because this sounds awesome, and I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit envious that you've got a totally badass drone to play with. But that's cool. when you're flying,
that makes all of us.
And you shoot that sucker straight up into the air like a billion friggin' thousand feet up. Do you have like a little battery indicator on your local display that tells you when you're about to fall from the sky, crash, and kill a baby?
So it's got one of the things that's cool about it is it comes with this massive handheld controller, right? You know, like for radio control cars, you have those oversized kind of controllers with loads of buttons and gadgets on. It comes with one of those, and there's an LCD display on there, and it shows you things like the altitude, the speed. It shows you how many GPS satellites are locked onto it. It shows you battery life, all kinds of stuff. There's loads of telemetry that's built into it, so like real drone nerds can find all that stuff out. But like I said in the review, you know, it's constantly assessing the battery life and distance. So you can, I'm assured from reading, and I've certainly experienced this myself, that there's no way in which you can have this thing run out of battery and have it fall out of the sky.
Because it just comes home when it's out of battery, right?
It just comes
15 home. Minutes, though, for that price range does seem astonishingly short.
It does, yeah. I mean, it's a 5400 whatever battery, I think it is.
So only slightly more than a phone.
It's
probably twice as much as a phone, I'd say.
Well, I was going to say that I think my phone's 3300.
Yeah.
It's a pretty epic lithium battery. I share the same thing. Like, you can't do a lot in 15 minutes. And yes, no, you can have more batteries, but like, if you want to have a longer flight, because as far as I'm aware, in the auto mode, you can basically draw a flight path and it will go as far as it can go and come back with the battery. So if you had a battery that lasted an hour, you could send it like miles and miles and miles away.
Right.
Because it's just locking onto GPS waypoints. But I'm hoping that the battery quality will improve as the future, in the future. But I don't know whether that's because the Iris Plus is inefficient or whether that's because just batteries suck. I mean,
that general 20 to 25 minutes seems to be what comparable drones are running it currently.
Yeah, exactly.
The quick research.
I mean, you do, to be fair to 3D Robotics, you do get better battery life if you don't have the GoPro and the gimbal on it. So you get more like 20, 22 minutes, I think.
Here's my real question. So this is, I think, unarguably a very cool device, right? Between the flight protection, which like you said, is when it comes back, that follow me thing is really, really cool. The fact that you can just circle on Google Maps and draw a flight path, awesome.
That's so cool.
Aside from the very low flight time. So what you're looking at, though, this is a very pricey thing, because you said it's $750, and that's true, but that's without any extras, right? That live view where it follows you, that's $350. The case is almost $300. The gimbal's over $200. It doesn't come with a GoPro at all, so that's another $400. You're at $2,000 really quickly, and the Parrot Bebop is $500 with a camera, and now there's no gimbal on that, and it's honestly not nearly as nice, but it's considerably cheaper. So the question really here is, would you buy this?
You know what, honestly, probably not. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not really a drone guy. Like, it for me, it's I find it difficult at times to kind of see the application. Like, I think if you want really high, if you're a filmmaker, or you're into photography or something like that, or you want to do mapping, I can see the application of this. Like, one of the things I didn't mention in the review is one of the things you can do with the Iris Plus is you can circle it around a building and then it will basically generate a 3D model of that building, for example.
That is ridiculous.
And it's really like, it's pretty accurate as well in the way it does that. I haven't tried it myself yet, but I've seen them do it at the 3D Robotics office. But so for me, it's like, I don't have a lot of application for it in my life, so therefore I probably wouldn't spend the money. But I can imagine if you're a filmmaker, for example, it's a lot cheaper to buy a $750 drone than hire a helicopter to get some certain aerial shots.
On that point, seems I reasonable. Totally agree. The big use for this sort of thing that everyone talks about is precisely that, making films. If you're OK Go making a video or your Top Gear or something, it's a hell of a lot easier to get one of these drones than it is to get a helicopter. But the other thing that we've heard people talking about with drones is Amazon delivery stuff, right?
Yeah.
Would you feel the remotest bit confident about sending the drone off to land somewhere you aren't in order to deliver, for example, a sandwich to your son at the park?
So maybe a more practical example. Imagine that I wanted to deliver a letter, right? So I could basically stick it on the bottom of this drone. if in terms of, I don't actually know whether you can put in a landing waypoint other than the one that you set off from. So if I could basically send it to, you know, the Walgreens down the road, I feel reasonably confident that it could do it. There's only really? One thing that shakes my confidence a little bit was the one time when I crashed it. I put it up and I basically flicked the switch to basically have it come back into land. And what happened is it basically, even if it's a lower altitude, what it does is it goes to a standard high altitude and then it basically starts coming down. Now, when it started coming down, it looked like it was going to land on my neighbor's car. However, in subsequent flights, what I've seen is that it starts lowering and then it kind of adjusts its position as it starts lowering. So I think I freaked out a little bit initially, started manually controlling it, thinking I could control it. I couldn't, and then slammed it into the side of my house. So awesome. Assuming that...
Now, that's the video you have to post right there.
Right?
Right, seriously.
This was the thing that made me laugh in the review is you say, you know, I was expecting to break it within minutes, and you did, in fact, break it within minutes.
It was like my third flight, in my defense. But the thing is that I haven't tested it enough times to see where it specifically lands. I mean, it's like anything with GPS. It's within a few feet. It's not within, right. like, centimeters.
Right.
But... it seems pretty accurate, and therefore I'd be pretty confident about that. It locks onto the GPS ridiculously quick. So I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that. The challenge is that the Iris Plus doesn't have any kind of detection of objects in the air. So right. for example, you'd need to set it to a certain height and it wouldn't avoid power lines. If it came into land and there was a power line in the way, it'd hit the power line.
And presumably, it doesn't have that detection. It also doesn't detect objects on the ground. So it will merrily land on someone's car without yes. noticing. Yeah.
Although, good. To be fair to it, none of the other ones in its price, even close to its price range, do that. So it's...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But that suggests to me that it's not oriented around flying off to somewhere you aren't and landing and delivering.
I was going to say, the Amazon drones, if you've seen them, are not $750 devices. They're very high-tech, very expensive devices, the test ones.
What's cool about it, and it's the same... I've shown a bunch of people. I showed Akit, my friend Adam it, I showed my family it. It's the same response every time when you set this thing off. You look at it and you think, okay, it's going to go kind of fairly high in the air and you'll fly it around, whatever. It's going to be like a radio control helicopter. When this thing goes off, you're like, holy shit. Like, this is a serious aerial vehicle.
I traveled all the way to America specifically and only to play with Jono's drone. and it's startling. Yeah, I mean, you go, okay, what do I do? And Jono gives me this thing. And I said, well, I'll just push the up button. And I pushed up and it kind of goes zoom up into the air. And you think, Jesus, it's gone. You know, yeah, and then you're looking at the little display on your phone and you think, God, it's like 4 kilometers away. Christ, that's really fast.
It is like, it's ridiculous. So given how small it is and given the fact that it's got, you know, a relatively small consumer battery in it, I think it's pretty impressive for what it is. I mean, again, I don't know a lot about the engineering. Well, the one thing I think is super cool is that it's open hardware and it's powered by open source. So it's, you know, it's neat that like the drones community really came together over this. And Chris Anderson, actually, I think he's the chairman of Drone Code, which is at the Linux Foundation where a lot of this code is maintained. But yeah, I'd say, you know, wrapping it up, I'd say, you know, from my experience of playing this, I've only ever played one drone. The Iris Plus is pretty cool. I'd consider it probably to be a much more serious drone than most of the other like cheaper ones because of its capabilities. From what I understand, the autopilot stuff is much more advanced and sophisticated than other drones. So yeah, I'd say that if people want to really get like a pretty serious drone, this is probably a good one to get. But if you don't want to spend that kind of money, then you should probably go and get something at Brookstones or whatever.
God, I will say the only thing I don't like about this review is that it sounds awesome and I can't afford one.
I know, I was just going to say something like that.
Well, that's because 3D robotics have moved on from making modems, which presumably they used to say.
So unless you've been living in a cave or are just not in the United States, one of the two, you've probably heard about the recent net neutrality ruling, and it's actually rulings, but the one we're going to initially focus on is that the recent ruling really turned the internet service providers into Title II common carriers. So what that allows is for the FCC to implement pretty specific open internet access rules that disallow things such as paid prioritization, blocking, tiering, and things like that. So for those listeners, I know the term net neutrality gets kind of tossed around a lot. Net neutrality really means is it's a principle where the internet service providers and governments, if there's, you know, municipal services, should treat all data on the internet equally. And that means not discriminating or charging differentially by user, by content, site, platform, application, type of traffic, type of equipment, mode of communication, whatever it may be. So what I think, what I'd like to talk about here at least is what do you guys think of that recent ruling specifically, and what do you think of net neutrality in general?
I mean, I'm not by any even single stretch of the imagination an expert on this, but it seems like net neutrality is obviously important. I think we'd probably all agree on that. The challenge in my mind is defining exactly what it means and exactly what it is, because I do see the point of some of the, of like the Comcast of the world from a commercial perspective, but then the, you know, the minute we start compromising on equality on the internet is the minute the whole thing goes to shit, right?
Yeah.
And it's, that's so it's exactly like, it's a tough thing. And I can understand as well how, look, there's like two sides of this. You've got pro net neutrality people who are quite entrenched in their viewpoint, and then you've got the anti-net neutrality people, or the pro capitalist people, however you want to describe it. I don't know if there is a term for the people who are against net neutrality.
Bastards.
I get Muppets is the
anti-net neutrality, I would say, is what they're called.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So here's one of the things I found really interesting about the pros and cons, right? So prominent supporters of net neutrality, and this is thoroughly unsurprising, are guys like Vinton Cerf, who was the co-inventor of IP, Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the web, Tim Wu, who's a law professor that actually coined the term, CEO of Netflix and Tumblr and all those guys. The thing that really surprised me in doing a little bit of research for this, so prominent opponents of net neutrality include Netscape founder Mark Andreessen, the other co-inventor of the IP protocol, which is Bob Kahn, Peter Thiel, who's involved with Facebook and PayPal and everything else, Nicholas Negroponte, which is was with XPRIZE and probably a little more well-known for being with the MIT.
Hang on a second, these are opponents?
These are all opponents. The number of people against net neutrality that you would think would not be is astonishing.
Yep. I'm amazed that Andreessen and Negroponte.
It was really, really, and they're all opposed for different reasons. Some of them are kind of like Peter Thiel's more of an economic reason. Bob Kahn's more of a technical reason, but they're all opposed to it,
right,
which is very, very surprising.
Just out of curiosity, just a quick straw poll. Are any of you guys opposed to the current ruling on net neutrality?
So here's the thing I really don't like about the current ruling on net neutrality, right, is that the details of the rule are not yet public, and that's ridiculous and stupid, but that's just how the FCC works. So it's tough to have an opinion because you don't know that.
I think
the devil is going to be in the details, and we just don't know the details.
We don't know the details. I mean, we know they've established that it's classifying it as a public utility now. We know that much. But there are different types of public utilities that can obtain different classification and different amounts of meddling from the federal government. My general feeling is this is probably a truly horrible thing, but I won't know until actually, again, I read the details. I like the general concept of net neutrality, but I hate the idea that the government gets involved in the internet as a communication mechanism. That to me just sounds like
complete
disaster.
They specifically reclassified
it
as Title II. So that part you do know.
Right. So we know it's Title II, but what they're going to do based on that, what the laws are going to say specifically around that, because a lot of the Title II laws are specific to the individual pieces of infrastructure. It's
right. The interesting thing about Title II classification is that it was defined in 1934.
Right.
Well, yeah.
When they didn't have very good broadband at all.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, man. Seriously, I think everyone just had, you know, 8 megabit or something back then, something like that.
Well, people had just those 3D robotics modems, you know.
What's interesting.
We'll just
here
pretend
is,
like the company US Robotics never existed at all.
Jeremy mentioned right at the beginning, you might not be interested in this if you're not in the US, but. A very similar discussion is going on in the EU Parliament at the moment about exactly the same topic, net neutrality.
Yeah.
And they've come up with a proposal, and basically everybody hates it. because the proposal in general comes down in favour of net neutrality, right? No discrimination on packets.
Sure.
But it also has stuff in there saying that providers are allowed to offer specialised services, which you are allowed to put in an internet fast lane, but doesn't define what a specialised service is.
Well, that's weird.
Which means that everybody's sitting that about thinking, weird. Oh, right, by specialised services, you mean from people with more money than me then. So everyone's dead unhappy about it. And that, I think, is what Brian's saying about the devil being in the details here, Brian and Jeremy both, that it's relatively easy to say to people, should you be allowed to prioritise some traffic? Answer, no. But how you turn that into a rule without right. banning, you know, anyone from running quality of service on their own LAN.
So do you think no one should be able to prioritize any? Because Google kind of came down directly in the middle of this, right? They're not really pro, they're out, not really anti. You know, if you listen to Eric Schmidt, what he said was Google views that similar data types shouldn't be able to be discriminated against, but it is okay to discriminate across different data types. So he wants, say, all web traffic to be the same, but you could QoS BitTorrent or something like that. So,
but
I'm
how do you define data
you guys,
to that point? I mean,
well,
do we,
no,
do
he's
we,
going
we,
by
we,
data type. So, what that data, data is, you can't do deep packet inspection and by Google's preference, you wouldn't be able to right. say web traffic would you could not change web traffic in any way or discriminate in any way, but you could discriminate for different kinds of traffic.
But would we consider Netflix and Google.com as different data types?
Well, this is exactly the point. You know, I mean, to my mind, if you say, well, you're not allowed to interfere with web traffic, but you're allowed to deprioritize BitTorrent, what happens is someone sits down and spends 15 minutes roughing together a version of the BitTorrent protocol, which is tunneled over HTTP,
yes.
and then you've got exactly the same problem, right?
And on the other
well,
side
you're
of
always
that,
I
think the incumbents here have been remarkably crafty in how they get around some of the current rulings, right? Because this argument's been going on for well over a decade, right? They changed the rules. What in 2002 I think is really yeah. when net neutrality kind of started being an issue.
Yeah.
And you look at what Comcast did was okay, we won't. They got in trouble for throttling BitTorrent, and they said okay, we won't throttle anything. But then at the peering points with Netflix, they downgraded their equipment basically, made it very slow. So Netflix, they weren't in any way prioritizing or deprioritizing. Their equipment was just quote unquote at capacity at those peering points.
Right. Which, so they went, okay, we're trying to serve
that. So by the letter of the law, they were not breaking the law, but Netflix was dog slow if you had Comcast. So
yeah, right.
That's, I think regardless of what laws you have here, it's going to be a cat and mouse game of the incumbent saying, oh, well, no, we're not, we're following the law, but we just, you know, we can't. And one of the things that's making me nervous is they're, and I personally don't think this is true. I don't know what you guys think, but a lot of the majors are saying that a Title II reclassification will cause a massive reduction in innovation and investments on their part. So they'll just never upgrade equipment and say, "Mup, see what happened?"
Oh,
and that
well,
makes me a little bit nervous.
I believe that
hell yeah.
to some extent that that's the case, but it's not clear to me that when people like that say, what we want to do is innovation, that it's actually innovation that we want anyway. You know?
Right.
But, well, oh, absolutely.
Well, I mean, in some cases, like the rolling out of, you know, fiber optics, you know, across like North America right now. I mean, those are things that we want. I mean, those are innovations we want. I guess here's
fiber optics are not an innovation. They've been around for 100 years.
No, it's an innovation in terms of what's available.
Well, fiber
the infrastructure
to the consumer prem is different. Yeah.
Having a dedicated fiber strand coming to your house is a pretty big innovation that didn't
really
exist before.
Here is the thing.
Not
yes.
in the United States anyway.
When they say, well, the fact that it's Title II will harm us doing innovative things, if they mean we're not going to invent new types of technology which you would find useful, I would agree with their argument. If what they mean is this thing that we already know how to do, so it's not innovative at all, we're just not going to do it, just in order that we can say, see, we told you so, right? Cut off your nose to spite your face as a business model, then fuck them.
Well, right?
Eventually, what happens if you do that sort of thing is it recoils upon you and all your customers leave.
Well, the thing is, as well, is I think part of the challenge here is that the term net neutrality, in many ways, I think when we think of it, as an ethos and as a movement and as a standard, right? Whereas in reality, and I think to Jeremy's point earlier on about Comcast, you there's only so much that the government can do and the FCC can do. I mean, obviously the FCC is a separate body. Like, Obama can't tell them what to do. But there's only so much that they can do, and companies are always going to do the very best that they can to squeeze their own agenda within the parameters of the law. And so in my mind, like, there's, you know, I have a vision of what net neutrality is, and I think we all share it, but is the reality going to be that? Probably not. And in my mind, what you do is you then have to go and choose your internet provider.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to have to vote with our feet to a degree. Like, and, you know, I'm speaking to someone who is with Comcast, right? I'm doing the opposite of what I'm saying here. But if Comcast keep doing this, I'm going to move away from them, because I don't want to support a company that is actively trying to sacrifice the internet in the way that I think it should be executed.
I think there is kind of a concern, a bit of a concern that, you know, your choice is basically, at least for some of the US, you get to choose between AT&T and Comcast, and they're the only games in town. But that's not... And the fact that, you know, if they come out against net neutrality, you have a problem. But that's not really a problem with net neutrality as a concept. It's just a problem with huge monopoly ISPs, right? Well,
that's kind of why I think the other ruling here might even be more interesting, although it's getting much less attention in the media, because I think net neutrality is not the root problem here, right? Lack of competition is. And yes, the other ruling... Right. Was that they preempted the state laws that, let's be honest, were generally written by the broadband providers themselves, that blocked municipalities and smaller companies from offering broadband. Yes. So I think that ruling could actually have a bigger impact long-term on the services that you see than the net neutrality ruling, even though net neutrality is currently getting way, way, way more attention.
Yeah, I think what Jeremy absolutely said is absolutely right. The one thing I will leave you guys with this particular thought. This ruling, or one of these rulings, classifies the internet, basically internet services and the infrastructure for it, as a public utility within the United States. If we look at other public utilities in the United States, they do, such as, let's say, water and electricity, they do not abide by the things that we would consider to be net neutrality or water or power neutrality. If you want more water, you have to pay oftentimes additional water suppliers or pay for the existing utility companies to provide bigger, thicker pipes to you. That simply, right, it goes against, basically what it comes down to is there's no existing standard that says the United States government getting involved will create a neutral environment for these internet packets that are flying around. In fact, it is exactly the opposite, which means with these rulings, we get a couple of little additional laws that may or may not help a little bit, but a long-standing tradition of the government totally fucking everything up for all of us. So I don't see it as going good in any possible way.
To enlarge on that point slightly, in order for the government to know that you are not violating the net neutrality law, they're going to have to get a bunch of little black boxes and stick them in every ISP, which, in another context, we're not particularly happy about as a concept.
Not big fans of.
Yep. So it's going to increase cost, reduce speed, reduce innovation, and increase litigation over everything.
I think I disagree with that. I would say it's definitely a battle in a war that is far, far from over.
So this seems to be a great topic of discussion in the community. I mean, things like this often flare up into lots of different perspectives. So what do you folks think about this? Do you agree with net neutrality as a concept? Are you an opponent? Are you with Nicholas Negroponte? And what do you think about the recent rulings? Like, where do you think the FCC fits into this? What do you think about the notion of net neutrality where you live, wherever you are in the world? Go to community.badvoltage.org. Let us know what you think.
And I actually would like to know one thing. While you had the community.badvoltage.org, and let us know what you think about it, I want to know the stupidest thing you've heard someone say in regard to net neutrality, because there's some hilarious quotes out there. I want you to pick your favorite and post it.
Oh, that's great. And we can maybe read them out on the next show.
Yeah.
All right, there we have it. That's the first show after the legend of Bad Voltage Live.
Dude.
We should probably talk about that.
We probably should
chat
about that.
So much fun. Yeah, that was a good time. So for those of you who don't know about it, which is probably no one who listens to the show, we flew out to the Southern California Linux Expo in Los Angeles. Thank you to System 76 for getting us out there. Thank you to Acelio for providing beer for the event, and to Pogo Linux for giving away a server. And who else are we missing?
I'd say Scale in general, guys. And Jono
gave us a raspberry pie or a banana pie or something. Yeah.
And, right. And Alan and Gareth for being quite sporting chaps and dressing up as clowns.
Yeah. So we went out, we did this live show. We put quite a lot of preparation into this, and there were some gags in that show that we weren't entirely sure were going to work, such as, you know, Brian taking his clothes off in front of an audience.
Turns out that works just fine.
It was fun. It was fun. And people seemed to enjoy it. Yeah. You know, I don't know about you guys. I was quite surprised that people stuck around for as long as they did. Because the video, so for those of you who don't know about this, we put out a video that shows the whole show in its entirety. And we trimmed some bits out of it. Like the beginning bit, George Castro did a great emceeing to get people revved up, which we're going to release a video of later on. And then we cut some of the Q&A out because it kind of dragged on a little bit. But it was like an hour and a half, that video. So the actual show lasted for probably nearly 2 hours. And people stuck around. It was amazing. These people must be bored. So, yeah.
No, it went really well. Jerv Markham did point out on community.badvantage.org that the audio alone, which I put out as a show, because I wanted, you know, I wanted people to get a chance to hear the show. And the show notes for that show did say, go and watch the video.
Yeah.
And he made it fairly clear that if you just listen to the audio and you didn't watch the video, you won't know what the hell is going on. Which is a reasonable criticism, I have to say.
Well, read the show notes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so you really want to be, if you're listening to this in some kind of podcast app and you listen to the previous show, the live show, in just a podcast app, and you haven't watched the video, watch the video.
Go
and watch
better.
The video. It makes a lot more sense. So even if you do have to see Brian's puffy nipples.
Damn it, I don't have puffy nipples.
Yes. we should talk about our dietary choices.
Should.
I'm fairly surprised to see that Stuart is still alive after that, to be honest with you.
It is rare that I go to another place and only eat one thing for the whole entire time I'm there.
Now, we should be clear to people. This takes place at a hotel convention center near the Los Angeles airport, and there are only two restaurants within easy walking distance, Carl's Jr. and Denny's. So the Carl's Jr. is directly across the street, which means that I believe, Stuart, how many instances of Carl's Jr. did you eat during that weekend?
How many? I think it was six.
Six. Six. I think it was.
Disgusting.
Every meal.
It's horrifying.
I managed to get to five. Go. I mean, a couple of people have been like, that's terrible. Why'd you do that? And it's not like there was a 5-star restaurant across the road and I was going, you know what? I'd rather not go there and go to Carl's Jr. and have a burger that's been stepped on. It's all
I did have lunch at the hotel once for the low, low price of $52. So that's also an option. Unbelievable. It's not like I got something crazy with like caviar on it. It was a sandwich.
I got a bowl of cornflakes and a banana downstairs, $22. So I went right back to Carl's Jr. for my next meal, and it was delightfully disgusting.
What was it, 14 foot long or something?
And cornflakes. There was cornflakes too.
The only compensation for being charged the extortionate amount of money for basic food and beverage at the hotel is the fact that you get to see that the people who charge you that money wear those stupid hats and outfits, right? They look like extras from Mary Poppins.
I
feel bad because every time I ordered anything, I remember going and buying a bottle of water and it was like $7. And I looked at the guy and I was like, really? Really?
It kind of made you want to just say, don't you mean $7?
And it's like, that guy must hear that every single time he gets a customer. Because it's obscene.
It is.
And it's not like we're staying at the Four Seasons. It's a freaking Hilton.
Right. No,
it's in the airport. I know.
It's an airport Hilton.
Exactly. The Ritz, I mean, it is not. It has to be. No.
They're one step up from a fucking vending machine, and they're charging.
It was a perfectly nice hotel, and their staff were very good. We were when we first got to the hotel, Jono and I were putting up posters to advertise the fact that Bad Voltage Live was going on, and we were sticking them on the walls. And then someone from the hotel showed up. Marissa, I think her name was.
Melissa,
I think, actually. And we thought, uh-oh, going to get a bollocking here. And we did, in fact, get a bollocking for sticking posters on her nice, shiny wooden walls. And so we thought, oh, well, what are we going to do now? Maybe sneak around and hide them or something. And then she says, oh, but I can give you some boards. You can put them on easels if you like. And we were genuinely blown away by the concept of a hotel member of staff being helpful in this.
She's actually very nice.
It's never happened to me before. And she was super helpful all weekend. She helped us sort out the bar for Bad Voltage Live and everything. She's great. Mm. We really like her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she was absolutely fantastic. And again, we should say a huge thank you to the scale organizers, and especially to the to Elon and Gareth, and to the AV team as well, Tom and the rest of the team, because, you know, we went into this with some fairly specific video needs and audio, and we had a shower tent and they owned it. And also George as well. I mean, George did such a great job getting the crowd revved up.
Yeah, I mean, given our Van Halen level of demands that we put on the team, they responded very decently, and we very much appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Nobody sucked.
And also kudos to Joe as well on the community forum for rallying the UK community to get together and me. And Joe got up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning to get the live stream and all the rest of it. So, So I think all round we had a good time, and hopefully we'll do it again.
Absolutely.
Fingers crossed, you know. So, if you are interested in having Bad Voltage perform live at your conference and you want to fly us to wherever it is, do feel free to let us
know.
We
do weddings. And weddings, bar mitzvahs.
I've never been to Australia, funerals. So if someone wants to speak up.
Yeah, we'll literally, we just need a warm drink and airfare paid.
Right, yeah. Our demands are quite low, very modest.
I would like to not have to sleep in the same bed as Jono Bacon this time, if I can possibly avoid it.
You guys do remember that.
It's actually a stipulation for every future show.
The ironic thing is, and this should be pointed out before we wrap up, Jono and Stuart shared a double bed for the entire weekend. I had a room to myself with two queen-size beds. I literally brought my puppet with me to Los Angeles, and my puppet had his own bed. I mentioned this to Stuart, and he's like, yeah, I might have to take you up on that. And then he managed to change the topic quickly, which means he was super stoked to get back to spooning with Bacon.
I mean, this is more of a reflection on you, Brian, that Ack would rather sleep in the same bed as me with my creeping fingers than share a room with you.
I ought to point out that the way the situation actually arises is I'm sitting there at 5:30 in the morning, drunk after having been to Denny's, and I look around and go, okay, Brian, I'm happy to take up that room. And then it turns out you went to bed 9 hours previously.
Yeah, I'm old, I know.
Seriously.
Although I will say, based on what you just said, if there is ever a spinoff of Bad Voltage that only has Jono, it will need to be called Spooning with Bacon.
That's what I'm calling the show now.
And it's creeping your fingers. All right, we're done. We're done.
And on that bombshell.
Over. Done. Boom.
Latest.
Yeah.